Okay, as I announced last week, we're going to do things a little bit different this evening. That is, we're not going to talk about the reading until the end of class. If you had a chance to do that, there's still a few, I think, of lesson five up there on the front pew. We may or may not actually get to the reading and to the discussion of that reading. Depends how fast I go through the slides. If we don't get to it this evening, we'll do it first thing probably. Next Wednesday, but I think we'll get there. And there's lesson six is also up there for next week's discussion. Again, it will probably be sometime during the class, probably at the end of class. Last week we were discussing Antiochus Epiphanes. He's sort of the central bad guy character of this period, the intertestamental period. We were talking about the fact he was trying to get everyone to give up Judaism. He thought Judaism was the root of his problem. And I thought I'd start with this reading. I know it's a little bit small probably for those in the back, so I'll go ahead and read it out loud. It says, moreover, this is from 1 Maccabees. Remember, we discussed 1 Maccabees before. Moreover, King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people, and everyone should leave his laws. So all the heathen agreed according to the commandments of the king. Yea, many also of Israel, of the Israelites, consented to his religion and sacrificed unto idols and profaned the Sabbath. For the king had sent letters by messengers unto Jerusalem and the cities of Judea that they should follow the strange laws of the land, and forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice and drink offerings in the temple, and that they should profane the Sabbaths and festival days, and pollute the sanctuary and the holy people, set up altars and groves and chapels of idols, and sacrifice swine's flesh and unclean beasts, that they should also leave their children uncircumcised, make their souls abominable with all manner of uncleanness and profanation, to the end that they might forget the law and change all the ordinances. And whosoever would not do according to the commandment of the king, he said he should die. In the selfsame manner wrote he to his whole kingdom and appointed overseers over all the people, commanding the cities of Judah to sacrifice city by city. Then many of the people were gathered unto them, to wit, every one that forsook the law, and so they committed evils in the land. I thought it was an interesting, you know, summary of the things we looked at last week. The fact that he said that, you know, you couldn't circumcise your babies, that they would take a woman with a circumcised baby and throw the woman and the baby off the walls of the city. They wouldn't allow sacrifices in the temple. They wouldn't allow basically Judaism at all. They wouldn't allow even Hebrew, we talked about last week. And I just wanted you to think, if you got put in that position where the power, the government was saying, basically, you can't worship God the way you have always worshipped God, what choices do you have? Sort of a thought question here. What choices do you... Not just necessarily what choice would you make, but what choices do you see sort of open to you? You can flee. You can just move to a different country. Or just hide out, right? You could either actually flee, get out of the country, or you could just move, you know, get off the grid, as they would say. Maybe you can hide in the mountains somewhere. What other choices might you have? You could comply. He talks about that. He calls them the heathen. Some Israelites, he said, became heathen. Some Israelites said, oh, okay, well, you know, we don't have any choice. So you can become I keep thinking of the Vichy for some reason in my head. You can work with the evil that's there. What other choice might you have?
Take the death sentence.
Go ahead and continue what you know to be right, and when they come to get you, then die. Rise up. Okay, there's at least one more. I was like, there's got to be at least somebody out here who's going to take the aggressive approach. You know, take up arms. Let's fight. And actually, I hope we'll get to at the very end of class. I'm glad you got all the different main choices, because we're going to see that the Jews did exactly all of that. It wasn't that, you know, some Jews did one and, you know, everybody just chose to go one direction or another. They did all those different choices. Some ran to other countries, some hid in their own country, some chose to rise up, some chose to give in, some chose to die. All those choices, and they all actually lead to sort of different groups, different divisions within Judaism that become prominent for hundreds of years, and actually some of them are still prominent now, over 2,000 years later, and their origins will be sort of in the aftermath of this. We'll talk about two that sort of come right off the bat, which is the Hasid versus the Hellenists. I haven't used the word Hasid. You might be familiar with it. Hasidic Judaism is still around today. The Hasid means the pure ones. And you can almost imagine. They consider themselves to be pure. And if you're pure, then which of those five choices that we came up with, four or five choices we came up with, which one do you think you're going to take if you're pure? I think you're going to take Franz's choice, right? You're going to keep doing what's right, and when you die, you die. Because they're pure. They're going to do what's right. And because the king was sort of pushing Greek onto everyone, if you're pure, you sort of have an overreaction the other direction, right? You detest everything Greek. Not that there's anything wrong with Greek. But, you know, because the king wants you to be Greek, then the Hasidic Jews of the time decided everything Greek is evil. Speaking Greek is evil. Writing Greek is evil. Greek is evil. They sort of equated the two. Well, those who gave in, kind of the opposite. Hey, Greek's good. You know, the Greek lifestyle's good. They've got lots of money. They've got lots of culture. You know, it's been around even back then. The Greek culture had been around, you know, thousands of years. You know, let's become part of it. And so two of the main camps within Judaism were the Hasid, trying to get further away from Greek life, trying to be more pure, more holy, and the Hellenists, those who are trying to become more Greek, trying to adopt Greek life, Greek ways of life. The Hasid, one of the interesting things as this persecution sort of ramps up, the Hasid start moving from village to village. They're poor. You might sort of guess why from last week, sort of those penalties phases. If you're a circumcised man, one of the penalties was you couldn't have any job, at least not one that is connected to the government. You couldn't have any sort of commerce. You couldn't run a business. Anything the government had to approve of. And so the Hasids start moving out into the villages. And they start going from village to village, teaching people, reminding people of the law. Kind of like, maybe you remember stories of the Catholic monks, right? So, you know, take on sort of the vow of poverty and you move around. Well, they weren't taking a vow of poverty. They were just poor. They were poor. They moved from town to town. They relied on people's generosity. You know, they would go and they would teach and people would feed them and they would move on. Right? So they didn't have a business. They weren't reliant on the government. And they started to adopt a let's be purer than pure attitude. That is, you know, let's not just make sure we don't do anything wrong. Let's make sure we don't get too close to doing anything wrong. And let's start teaching people not to get too close. In later writings, the Hasidic Jews will talk about having a hedge around the law. You know, we don't want you to break the law, so we'll build the wall back here. And that way you won't get too close to breaking the law. Not that what they were doing was wrong, right? If they're back here and the sin's over there, they're okay, right? The problem was they were telling people who were in between, hey, that's wrong. You can't be in between. Right? They wanted everybody to stay, 10 feet away from the edge of the, of the law, just in case. And then they came up with an idea that, maybe everyone in Judaism should live like priests. The priests, if you read through Leviticus especially, the priests had all kinds of requirements that every other person didn't have, like their washings. If you ever thought about it in the New Testament, when the Pharisees are asking Jesus about, why don't your disciples wash their hands? The reason they were washing their hands is because the Hasid had started teaching 100 plus years earlier, everybody should be like a priest, and the priest before sacrifice had to wash his hands in the laver that was there, the little pool, later the great big pool in Solomon's days. Well, if it's good enough for the priest, then we should all do it. And the priest had to do it before sacrifice. They said, hey, let's do it before every meal. Every time we touch food, let's all wash our hands. Now, there's nothing wrong with washing your hands. Jesus didn't say there was something wrong with it, right? The problem was telling somebody, you sinned when you didn't do it. The law never required anyone other than the priest to wash their hands. And then it was only for the sacrifice. It wasn't for the meal. And that's why Jesus said, you're sinning by making your tradition equal to the law. Their tradition wasn't wrong. It was just their saying that other people had sinned. The Hellenists, because they were generally the wealthier people, that's why, they were adopting Greek life because they wanted that commerce. They wanted to be able to be merchants. They wanted to have the protections of government. They also wanted the power. Remember the Greeks, we talked about last week, had formed a ruling council, sort of to help them Hellenize this community. And the Hellenists sort of joined that. One of the positions the Greeks put in charge of that was the high priesthood. Remember we talked last week, the high priesthood was sort of in a bought and sold position. We'll talk more about that probably next week, if we get to it, about what happened to the high priesthood. But during this phase, while the Greek Athenian senator was in charge, it was up for sale. You want to be high priest this year? Sure, just pay me more than the guy next to you wants to pay me, and we'll have an auction basically every year. Whoever comes up with the highest bid gets to be priest, as long as he can actually fork over the money. We'll give him the robes. He's priest. He's in charge of the council. A lot of power and prestige. And what else are you in charge of if you're high priest? Treasury. You're in charge of the treasury of the temple. So a lot of times the high priest would get in and start lining his own pocket with money from the treasury, and that way he can afford to pay next year's bribe and keep the high priesthood. It was a good paying thing to be high priest. Well, not everyone took one of these two extremes. I want to tell you the story of an elderly man. His name was Mattathias. He was a Levite. Nowhere in the Maccabees does it say he was a priest. That was an invention of latter-day Judaism. They decided to rewrite history and make him into a descendant of Aaron. He does not claim that, never did. But he was a Levite. And when they came to his town, we read in Maccabees, they went from town to town. When they came to his town, his village, they brought their altar, they brought their pigs. They asked him, the oldest man who was there, to be the first one to sacrifice to Zeus. They brought a little statue of Zeus. Remember, Antiochus Epiphanes thought he was Zeus. Told him to sacrifice upon the altar. He said no. And once he said no, somebody else in the village said, I'll do it, and stepped forward, right? Hellenist. Somebody said, I'll be the first one. And Mattathias grabbed the spear from one of the soldiers and ran him through. Might remind you of one of the sons of Aaron, Phinehas, who similarly did when they were committing fornication. He grabbed the spear, he ran it through this man who wanted to sacrifice pigs upon an altar to Zeus. And then, I guess you could say, being a wise man, Mattathias turned and ran from the village, calling for his sons, who were all adults at the time. Mattathias was already in his late 60s, called for his sons to follow him, and they all ran from the village. The stunned soldiers just stared for a while before figuring out, hey, we should be chasing the man. I guess it wasn't what they were expecting, have a murder happen right in front of them. And the villagers started spreading the news. Hey, Mattathias is revolting against the Greeks. And people started talking about it from village to village. The word spread. And people who were willing to join up went to Mattathias. He was hiding out in the forest nearby. People started joining, flocking to him. Some of the seeds started coming to him. And they made a separate camp. Kind of interesting. They got close. They didn't want to get too close. They came out to the forest. They made their own camp in the forest. Mattathias told them, he told even the Hasid, he said, this is war. And if they come for us, we're going to have to, do whatever it takes. And in the early days, the Greeks were kind of clever. They waited and gathered some soldiers and decided that the best time to strike Jews, yeah, you can already guess, right? What day of the week? Get them on Sabbath day, right? They're not going to pick up arms. They're not going to fight. They're not even going to flee, right? It's Sabbath day. Greeks were smart. They surrounded the forest that everybody said they were in, and they charged in on Sabbath day. Mattathias told everybody, we have to flee. Charge together. We'll break through. And his followers broke through. That group of the Hasid sat in their tents and waited. As Franz said, waited to die. And they were slaughtered. And you sort of see the outcomes of two different, two different choices. But Mattathias was old. He knew he wasn't going to live long. He was ill, hiding out in the forest. And before the year was out, he had already passed away. So we don't really hear much about Mattathias. We don't call it the Mattathias Revolt, even though he was the one who started the rebellion. The rebellion became named for one of his sons, Judas. His son Judas turned out to be one of those great warriors who never knew he was a warrior. A great strategist, great tactician. He took over the military, started guerrilla operations, because the Greeks, kind of like the British in our Revolutionary War, the Greeks thought the best way to fight a war was how they fought it against the Persians, which is you line up your troops, they line up their troops, you crash together, and whoever's got the stronger troops and the better equipment comes out the winner, and you try sneaky things like, using your cavalry to go around, and that's pretty much all there is to war. Judas was smart enough to realize he had a few hundred men to begin with. The Greeks had a few thousand men to begin with. That wasn't going to work. And so he hid in the forest, and when the Greeks came by, he ambushed them, threw spears, threw rocks, got up on the mountains, and when Greeks went by underneath, he pushed rocks off the top and crushed them. Whatever it took. He brought his men to the north, and when resupply wagons came down, he stole them before they got down to where the soldiers were. They quickly learned they needed soldiers to guard the supply wagons. But this is how Judas worked. And it started working very well. It drove the Greeks crazy. He wouldn't stand and fight. Eventually, the king hears. He sent some of his best generals down there to try to, corral this rebellion. And it wasn't working. He kept sending more and more tens of thousands of troops. And they kept dying. Not in big battles, but in little battles. They would sneak into camps at night and slice throats and then sneak back out. It might only be a dozen or so people who died, but it was really frightening for soldiers to go to sleep at night. And finally the king says, okay, we're going to do this with war elephants. They always go back to the war elephants. These Judeans have no idea what's coming. They've never even seen a war elephant. But he only had one, because remember the Romans had taken away all his war elephants, his dad's war elephants. He only had one. So he brings down the war elephant, leads the charge, and sure enough, the Maccabees are really frightened by this big, huge creature coming through the mountain pass. One of Judas's brothers, one of his younger brothers, Eleazar, whips out a sword, runs underneath the elephant, and stabs upward, showing how little he knew about elephants, because when they die, they drop to their belly. But he did save the day. Everybody, you know, the rebellion was saved. The war elephant was dead. Eleazar, that was the end of Eleazar, but that's the only one of his brothers who died during the war. After a while, his men gave him the nickname, Judas, the nickname the Maccabee, meaning the hammer. That's the word Maccabee is hammer. He was like a hammer just pounding over and over and over again. That's how they described him. He was just like a hammer going after the piece of steel that was the Greeks, and he was slowly bending it, slowly destroying the Greeks. Antiochus tried for a while to send more and more men, eventually realizing it just wasn't working very well. And after 3 years of open war, about 6 years after the reforms started that led to the war, Judas Maccabee had driven all the soldiers out of Jerusalem and had recaptured the city and recaptured the temple. Of course, once you've got the temple captured, it's had pig's blood on it. I think it's in the reading I have up there. I might have it up here, come to think of it. He has to go about cleaning the temple spiritually as well as physically. And exactly what happened is a matter for some debate. I'm going to read two different histories of the event, and we'll explain the difference. And you'll have heard probably the second one. You may not have heard the first one exactly. The first one's another long reading, sorry for that, from 1 Maccabees. But it says, he, speaking of Judas Maccabee, selected priests who were blameless, devoted to the law. They cleansed the sanctuary and took the polluted stones to a ritually unclean place. They discussed what to do about the altar for entirely burned offerings, since it had been polluted. They decided it was best to tear it down so that it wouldn't be a lasting, shameful reminder to them of the Gentiles who had defiled it. So they tore down the altar. They stored the stones in a convenient place on the Temple Mount until a prophet should arise who could say what to do with them. They then took unfinished stones in keeping with the law and built a new altar like the former one. They also restored the sanctuary in the temple interior, dedicated the courtyards. They fashioned a new holy equipment and brought the lampstand, the incense altar, and the table into the temple. Then they offered incense on the altar and lit the lamps on the lampstands, which illuminated the temple. They placed bread on the table, hung curtains. Finally, they completed all the work that they had started. They rose early in the morning of the 25th day of the ninth month, the month of Kislev, offered sacrifice following the law on the new altar for entirely burned offerings that they had made. It was dedicated with songs, harps, lutes, and cymbals. All the people bowed to the ground and worshipped and blessed heaven, which had given them success. So they celebrated the rededication of the altar for 8 days and joyfully made entirely burnt offerings. They offered a sacrifice of the deliverance and praise. Now, you may or may not recognize the story as it's told there. Anyone know what the story is today, or what feast? Hanukkah. Now, they celebrate Hanukkah today a little bit differently, and they tell a different story for Hanukkah. But this was the Maccabees story, 1 Maccabees. A historian who lived not long after the events. The Jews today have anyone know the extra little bit that the Jews have sort of added to the story? About the oil, right? If you've heard the story, And it comes from something called the Babylonian Talmud. Talmud, we'll talk about it in another lesson. Talmud is one of the collections of the writings of the rabbis, the famous Jews. It says, our rabbis taught it is incumbent to place the Hanukkah lamp by the door of one's house on the outside if one dwells in an upper chamber, place it in the window nearest the street, but in times of danger it is sufficient to place it on the table. Rabba said, another lamp is required for its light to be used, yet if there is a blazing fire, it is unnecessary. But in the case of an important person, even if there is a blazing fire, another lamp is required. What is the reason for Hanukkah? For our rabbis taught on the 25th of Kislev, beginning the days of Hanukkah, which are 8, during which lamentation for the dead and fasting are forbidden. For when the Greeks entered the temple, they defiled all the oils in it, and when the Hasmonean dynasty prevailed against and defeated them, they, the Hasmoneans, searched and found only one cruse of oil, which possessed the seal of the high priest, but which contained sufficient oil for only one day's lighting. Yet a miracle occurred there, and they lit the lamp for 8 days. And the following year, these days were appointed a festival with the recitation of Hallel and Thanksgiving. Now, you might notice at the very bottom there, I gave you an approximate date for the writing of the Babylonian Talmud. Basically, 5 to 600 AD is when this collection was put together. You can almost imagine how it happened, right? I mean, 600 years, 700 years. Somebody came up with this story and told the story to somebody. Somebody else liked it and spread the story. And eventually, the story becomes so well known that they can just say, they can't point to any particular rabbi. The rabbis taught. You know, I'm sure somebody said it somewhere that this was the truth. I'll give you an example of stories that you all know that, you know, just aren't so. Right, we've all heard the story of George Washington cutting down the cherry tree. Sorry to break it to you, never happened. You know, but we all know it. We all know it's true because we all heard it so many times. All right, I cannot tell a lie, Father. I'm the one who chopped down the cherry tree. Never happened. Nothing, at least contemporary with Washington, ever expressed it. First recording of it was over 100 years after Washington was dead. You know, some stories, they just get told from person to person. People like it, they tell it again. And soon, everybody's telling the same story. And I think that's probably how this Hanukkah story got going. And today, they call it the Feast of Lights. Where actually, Hanukkah doesn't mean Feast of Lights at all. Hanukkah means dedication. And you might be surprised to learn it's actually in the Bible. It's in John. Somebody read that for us. Just the first couple of verses. You don't have to read all the way down to 39. John chapter 10. Start with verse 22 and read, say 24, 25, wherever you see a convenient stopping spot.
At that time, the Feast of Dedication took place at Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was walking in the temple in the colony of Solomon. So the Jews gathered around him and said to him, how long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. Jesus answered them, I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name bear witness about me, but you do not believe because you are not among my sheep. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. I give them eternal life, and they will never perish, and no one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one.
Okay, that's a good spot. Jesus was there during the Feast of Dedication. The word there is Hanukkah. It's the same word. He was there during the feast. Somebody, I think of Stephen I was talking with, you know, is there anything wrong with Hanukkah? I said, well, apparently not. Jesus was there during the feast, didn't condemn them for this feast. I think he would have condemned them if they had said, you had to be there for that feast. All right, because it was a tradition. Again, the tradition wasn't wrong. Wasn't something that was required. This is the only time we know that he came during the Feast of Hanukkah. Even tells us it was winter, because Hanukkah occurs when's Kislev? December. 25th of Kislev is not 25th of December. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. Jewish calendar is not quite the same. It actually, Kislev starts in the middle of November and goes into about the middle of December. But it's during that period. Jesus was there. It was winter. John records those things for us. Some people think John 8, where Jesus said, "I am the light of the world," might have also occurred during a feast of dedication, but we're not told that. This is the only spot where it gets brought up in the New Testament. The name Feast of Lights, Festival of Lights, actually came from Josephus. Josephus wrote, first century. The reading I have for next week is from Josephus. We'll talk more about Josephus next week. Probably. It's interesting because Josephus never actually mentions the burning oil story. Second Maccabees, we talked about last week, Second Maccabees is the guy who always wanted to find God doing something, you know, great in everything. And he doesn't mention the oil story. His is almost word for word the exact same as First Maccabees, with a little bit more praise, you know, giving a few examples of praise to God. But he doesn't come up with the oil story either. Yeah. Yes, it is. At least you have Jesus. At least you know attended a Hanukkah, no Christmas celebration. Yeah. But perhaps the adding the oil bit was you know just a superstition that came along later. I would say you know. God was certainly capable of it. Maybe that's how they came up with the idea. We know from stories of Elisha and Elijah that God certainly was able to multiply oil. So, you know, if God had wanted to, that certainly was possible. But I think the first Maccabee writer or the second Maccabee writer would have made mention of it if it had happened, because that would have been a notable sign of God's presence. And maybe that's the reason the story came about. People wanted something that says God approves. You know, want a little his stamp of approval, kind of like Second Maccabees making up the stories about Nehemiah and Jeremiah and God with the fire and all those things. So I just wanted you to know, you know, where that came from, and you know that there is at least a little scriptural scriptural behind that. Well, the story wasn't over at that point. That was capturing Jerusalem, but the battle went on. The Hasid finally came back. They had stayed away after the big slaughter of their brethren in the forest. The Hasid finally come back, and they said, "Hey, we've been right there with you the whole time," you know? Which they hadn't, of course. With the city taken, Menelaus, remember who Menelaus was? He was the guy who paid Antiochus to make him high priest, to kick out Jason, the brother of Onias, the high priest. Menelaus was captured and executed by the Maccabees. But he wasn't actually high priest at that time. Somebody else had bought the office. That person fled and went to Antiochus. After all, he'd already paid Antiochus to make him high priest. He went back to Antiochus. The real high priest, in the meantime, Onias III, had fled to Egypt. I pointed out last week, Antiochus had apparently hired men to track down and kill the sons of Zadok, including Onias. And he was assassinated, murdered, somewhere in the south of Egypt. Somewhere around 163, right about the time, maybe just shortly after the temple had been rededicated. Some people think he might have been traveling to come back to the temple when he was killed. But he never made it back, and none of his children ever made it back. He did have children, Onias the IV, but he never made it back to the temple. And that's led to all kinds of people thinking, well, maybe one of them escaped, and maybe... maybe that Mattathias and his sons were descendants, which actually doesn't make any sense because they were already alive when Onias the Fourth. But they try to make those kind of stories. The war with the Seleucids had sort of died out for about 3 years, recovering from the loss of Jerusalem and of so much of his army. Antiochus finally sends another army after the high priest, I can't remember the guy's name, the current high priest, the one who had paid for it, had come back. And so a new army from the Seleucids came back to Judea. And Judas was ready to fight them again. He gathered his troops. The Hasid said they wanted to go this time. They were with him. And they all marched north to meet them in the valley of Megiddo, a good place to stop a foreign army. As soon as the Hasid got a good look at the foreign army, which was quite a bit larger than Judas's army, the Hasid thought it was a good time to run away again. And Judas Maccabee and his followers stood their ground, and they died there at the Valley of Megiddo. And I'm sure the Seleucids were very happy, thinking, okay, the hammer's dead, so you know now we can take Judea back. But instead, his two brothers, still surviving, Simon and Jonathan, took over control. They became co-rulers. They did something interesting. They didn't have a high priest. No known descendant of Aaron, of Zadok, was there. They were Levites, and they just sort of split the rule between them and said, okay, Jonathan, you get to be high priest. Simon, you get to be king. And so they declared themselves king and high priest, became co-rulers together. Jonathan, interesting, they chose the high priest to lead the army. But Jonathan was going to lead the army and go to fight the invaders that had just wiped out Judas. He got such a large army, there was a huge uprising when people heard that Judas had died and been sort of betrayed by the Hasid. Jonathan brought a huge army, even bigger than the Seleucid army. And the Seleucid king was kind of clever, or the Seleucid general, Nicanor. He was kind of clever. He said, hey, you know, we can have a peace settlement. Let's work on terms. And Jonathan agreed to it, thought that would be a good idea. And then as soon as Jonathan got in, he betrayed him, captured Jonathan, the high priest. And the general thought, okay, now the army will go away. I've caught their high priest and general. And to his surprise, Simon had come up, the king, and Simon took over as general, and the army was still there. And so he came up with another clever plan. He said, okay, give me 100 talents of gold, a lot of money, and give me Jonathan's two sons as my political hostages, and I'll set Jonathan free. And for some reason, I guess because they weren't Judas, Simon bought the bought a hook, line, and sinker, as they say. He turned over 100 talents and Jonathan's two sons. Nicanor, the Seleucid general, then publicly executed Jonathan, kept the 100 talents of gold. Don't know what happened to the two sons. Most people think they were sold into slavery. And then he marched his army against Simon, thinking now they would be disheartened. After all, they just watched their high priest get publicly executed, as well as their general. He wasn't really counting on Simon. Simon was actually almost as good a general as Judas was. Maybe not as bright as far as paying the ransom. But Simon holds him off, first for a few days there in the valley, then it becomes a few weeks, and then it becomes a few months, and then it becomes a few years, and it drags on year after year after year, and they can never seem to get through the valley. And finally, the Seleucid king says, you know, that's just enough of that. Let's make peace. And so in 142 BC, it's no longer Antiochus. He has died, if I remember right. But they get a peace proclaimed. And Simon is acclaimed to be both high priest and king. Why is that interesting? Okay, like Melchizedek. And it hasn't happened before. There's never been a high priest who's king. Why not? High priests were from what line? Levi, and from Aaron specifically. Kings? Judah from David specifically. And Simon's not either one. He's not a descendant of David at all. He's a Levite. He is a Levite, but he's not a descendant of Aaron. But they declare him. It's kind of interesting. They did it by a vote. That's a very Greek thing to do, to vote for office. So these people who are opposed to the Greeks, you know, actually have started to become Hellenistic in a sense. And he begins what's called the Hasmonean dynasty, or the Hasmonean dynasty. Nobody knows where the name came from. Jews like to think that maybe one of Mattathias' ancestors was named Asmoneus. You'll see that in one of the readings. It's just a made-up name. Just take the word Hasmonean. Most people kind of believe the second one, that it breaks down to Ha-Simon-ian, that is, the house of Simon. It becomes, you know, his own legacy. Simon dies 7 years later, 135 BC. And Simon's son, John Hyrcanus, who even made coins again. We get to start seeing what they look like because they actually did coins. Became both king and high priest again. He continued to pay tribute. That's how they got their peace. They paid an annual fee to the Seleucids, and the Seleucids let them do whatever they wanted. That way they didn't have to keep fighting over in the valley of Megiddo. But then the Seleucid king dies in a war with Parthia in 129 BC. And as soon as he's dead, John Hyrcanus says, forget tribute. You know, that's out the window. Let's declare independence. And he declares independence. He marches into Samaria. We talked about it in our lesson on the Samaritan temple. John Hyrcanus is the one who marched up there and who left those few blocks of stone because he knocked down their temple. He then conquered Idumea, or Edom, as we knew it from the Old Testament, and forced all the Idumeans to be circumcised. Why would they be circumcised? Become Jews, right? It's becoming Jews by the sword. He was making them become Jews, whether they liked it or not. One point about that, Idumeans lead to what Idumeans in the New Testament? The Herods, right? The Herods, the Idumeans. So they're descendants of Edom. He then conquered the Transjordan, that is the area, what we call Jordan today, the area across the Jordan River. And people started to call him the Messiah. I mean, he's king and high priest. He's a conqueror. He's driving out the enemy. He's made them free. And it's about the right time. Jews started, you know, furiously trying to figure out Daniel and trying to count the days and all kinds of, we'll look at a couple of them in some of the readings, including the one you had for this week, which we'll get to next week. But they started trying to figure out the days because they knew it had to be close. So maybe John Hyrcanus was the Messiah. He never claimed to be the Messiah, but people thought he was. But eventually he got old. He died. But before he died, he proclaimed that he thought the kingship should pass to his wife. And the high priesthood should pass to his son, splitting the two again. If you were his son, How would you feel about Dad saying, we're gonna give this, we're gonna split up the kingship and the high priesthood? Everybody's kind here and loves their mom, right? It was his stepmom, really. It wasn't his mom. So he locked her up. The day his dad died, he put mom in prison. And then he says he forgot to feed her. She starves to death. He also arrested and jailed his three brothers. He did remember to feed his brothers. Within just a few months, he dies of terrible intestinal pains. Remind you of who? Herod. Yeah, all these stories keep coming around again. He dies from terrible intestinal pains. They don't know how he, exactly what caused it. But the brothers were released, and his oldest brother, surviving brother, Alexander, becomes the ruler in 103, same year that Aristobulus had become priest. That's Aristobulus at the top, Alexander at the bottom. Alexander lost the Transjordan. They were raided by Arabia, the Nabataeans. Some Jews actually sided with the Seleucids and tried to retake Judea. And to give you an idea of his character, he caught 800 of the people who had tried to overthrow him and had them crucified. It was a kind of a new thing, crucifixion. It was very brutal. He had them publicly displayed all around Jerusalem, basically saying, don't try that again. And sort of a New Testament point also, Herodias, who I point out was the wife of Philip as well as Herod Antipas, the mother of Salome. What was she noted for besides all those things? She asked for whose head? John the Baptist. This was her great-great-grandpa. You can say it runs in the family, right? That sort of stays in the family as far as... Well, we won't get to the... I have five different parties there, sort of based on the answers we had as to, do you stay, do you fight, do you... And we'll talk about the reading at the end of that. We'll start our discussion next week. Anyone got comments or questions? We got like half a minute.